Independent. Yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Hale, and with me as so often is Brandon. This is actually the second part of a little micro-series we're doing. Last week we did the first part covering the Elephant Graveyard's YouTube video essay and philosophical investigation, comedy video, a whole bunch of different things. About the video is actually titled "How Comedy Was Destroyed by an Anti-Reality Doomsday Cult." Quite a interesting title, a lot going on there, and it's more on the nose than you would think, unfortunately. This is the second part. We're going to try our best to give a little rehash for our listeners who didn't catch the first part of what we talked about last week, and then we're going to explore a kind of secondary philosophical idea that we didn't get to last week that's really core to the video and core to the messaging and we thought was very interesting. Before we do that, though, we want to get into our little opener that we've been doing for quite a while now, the quote and quandary, or quote or quandary. This week, we just have a quote I brought because we want to get in the meat of the episode. But I brought a little poem that is reflective of some other stuff that we've covered recently, particularly around things like independent thinking, madness, relationship of independent thinking to communities. Our little quote today is actually a short poem, very short. It's by Emily Dickinson. It's called "Much Madness is the Divinest Sense," or the Divinest Sense. So "Much Madness is the Divinest Sense," by Emily Dickinson. This is from the 19th century. So the poem goes like this. "Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense, the starkest madness. This is the majority. In this, as all prevails. Assent, and you are sane. Demur, and you're straightaway dangerous and handled with a chain." Now, the reason that that poem stuck out to me is because we had talked a few times recently about the nature of madness and mental health in the context of philosophy. Now, of course, we don't want to be romanticizing severe mental illness. I don't think that's the point of this poem. I think the point is more that strange, out there, esoteric, and unique ideas are often seen as crazy. So yeah, and then the other side of it too that we've talked about previously in episodes is the fact that there's a certain, well, again, we don't want to romanticize a kind of like serious mental health issue. There is a certain mental flexibility that's required and can kind of seem quite eccentric often when it comes to new ideas and thinking outside the box and going against the grain or the herd or whatever, right? If one has, you know, and she says, you know, "'Tis the majority in all in this all as all prevails, assent and you are sane." Basically, you know, like within the confines of what's considered normal, you know, there's a certain layout for how to think and what to think about and what to be concerned with and what kind of opinions to hold. And going against that, you know, or going with that is what normal people do. And going against that is what, you know, quote unquote, crazy people do or whatever. So thought it was an interesting little poem. And, you know, we're always exploring new and kind of out there ideas. So a lot of people kind of would take a little snide glance at or a second look, so, or not want to take a second look. So yeah, you got to be a little bit crazy to think outside the box.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, I think that there is this resemblance that often gets taken as an identity between something like insanity and thinking outside the box, right? Like if you think about the concept of the genius, we tend to, this is the romanticization of you know, creativity or some kind of ecstatic thinking. But it's easy to you know, equate or even mistake the genius for someone who is insane because they're seeing or thinking past certain structures or the ways that we think. Now, I think your point about avoiding romanticizing this is really important. And it's when we are doing philosophy, it's easy to appear like what we're doing is kind of insane because we're trying to think outside the box. We're trying to push the envelope as far as the frameworks within which we think. The difference, I think, between insanity is that a person who is giving a critical approach can give the account of that critical approach. They understand the framework within which they're criticizing, and they can articulate it, and they can communicate that articulation to the people that do exist within that framework. So it's not just pure shaking down a particular framework by, you know, having a kind of reaction to that particular framework, whatever it may be within a culture or like a system. You can give a rational account of what's going on, and you can relay that to the people that are in it. And hopefully, if your account is morally relevant or there's some stake that's at play here, you can exfiltrate the people from that, right? I mean, come on, this is the cave. This is the cave analogy. You can go back into the cave and you can take them out of it.
Yeah, I think that's, and that's the interesting thing, especially with that poem, is that, you know, looking at it, like, obviously, Dickinson is I think, clearly alluding to having ideas and critical theories of her own time and culture that, you know, are called crazy. But there are things, like you say, that you can account for, right? There's a reliability in the thinking. There's a structure, there's a coherence, there's an ability to communicate that, you know, as opposed to actually our quote from a couple episodes ago, where from a short story by Ernest Hemingway, where a character who is actually, you know, has its actual significant mental health concerns, you know, basically states that, like, you know, when someone asks that, he asks another character if he's been crazy, and that character says no, and then asks him what crazy is being like, and he says, you know, when it happens to you, you don't even know. And that epistemological aspect, that aspect of knowledge, being able to take account of, being self-aware of, is the kind of, I think, the stark difference between what you might call eccentric thought, like thought outside of the box, new ideas, but ones which have some coherence, and actual madness, which has a character of being unknown and chaotic, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking about specifically in Wittgenstein's work On Certainty. He has this idea of asking a friend who's lived at a house for 20 years. He starts saying, like, hey, do you know where I live? And he says, what kind of mistake could that be? Like, you can't make that mistake. That has to be something like a mental disturbance. This is not a philosophical problem. This is a psychiatric issue, right? So there are kinds of that is a very out of the box way to think, but that doesn't mean that it is some kind of way of seeing. It's actually a distorted way of seeing. Something's wrong.
Yeah. And speaking of a distorted way of seeing, why don't we jump into some of our characters for today? We want to be kind of quick, but as an account for our listeners, this is a second part episode covering the Elephant Graveyard's YouTube video essay, how comedy was destroyed by an anti-reality doomsday cult that also happens to be mostly Americans. But we really encourage listeners to go and watch the video, watch the content. Both of us are fans of his work, and it's really quite impressive, and it's quite entertaining. It's quite entertaining as well. It is actually quite funny. But there's a lot of philosophical ideas baked into his work, and especially this particular video that's gained a lot of traction online. And, you know, last episode we focused on probably the primary philosophical idea within the context of the work in general, which is the hyperreal simulacrum. And to give a very, because people are probably listening, like, what the heck is that? And it is a little bit of a complex idea. It was coined by the sociologist Jean Baudrillard, who is notoriously difficult to read. But, you know, really, the hyperreal simulacrum, just as a generic definition describes the postmodern condition where simulations and artificial models, this is like the key one, simulations and artificial models become so dominant and pervasive that they replace reality itself, or what in the video was called classic reality, and eventually it becoming more real and compelling than any original reality. So that's where, again, where simulations and artificial models become so dominant and pervasive that they replace reality itself. This is a philosophical idea that's deeply tied to modern technology. You can't undo this theory from theories of technology and theories of media, present media that we've been talking, that we frequently talked about on the show, as our listeners probably know. And to put it in the simplest terms, or to kind of reframe that, basically it's where you have a collection of individuals, of participants, community, whatever, that engage with technology in such a way that what their relationship with that technology and the relationship with each other through that technology is directed and forms a whole new reality space that is all encompassing. It's entering a new world. And as the Elephant Graveyard kind of says, these people, it's all about migrations, right? that baked into human DNA is this idea to migrate, to, as he puts it, to get you look around and you go, I got to get the hell out of here. And a lot of these hyper real simulacrum, and many times offers a whole new world and system, and most importantly, identity for those individuals who enter. And as he puts it in the video, you become the transition to a whole new guy, right? You can become this, you migrate to a new space, a new world, and you become a new guy. And within the context of the video, he uses Joe Rogan in the comedy sphere and the kind of wider comedy sphere that sort of orbited that as an example of what a hyperreal simulacrum looks like. And he also uses the analogy, I think quite aptly, of these hyperreal simulacrums operating much like a cult. He actually makes pretty much a one-to-one comparison with Heaven's Gate. So the comedy sphere, for those of you who don't know Heaven's Gate was a very insular cult that existed from like the 70s to the 90s that was based around this guy, Marshall Applewhite, and his partner who passed away, partway through. It doesn't even really matter. But basically they had it was a weird blend of science fiction and esoteric Christian theology mixed together, and they were very insular, and they were very much had the features that make a good, make a good strong cult. And ultimately, most famously, they committed ritualistic mass suicide as a relationship to their beliefs, which in itself is interesting, and we'll kind of get into this topic a little bit, but it also shows the level of devotion and commitment to individuals who can make this migration and make this transition, where really the difference between this new hyper reality that you're in versus the classic reality that you've come from is so stark that you can't see outside of the hyper real once you're within it. You're fully committed, you're there, you're present, right? Just maybe before we get into some of the other concepts and ideas that we want to talk about today, I think it's worth stating two main situations going on within the context of this. So there's the four pillars of any sort of hyper-real simulacrum, which are pretty much equivalent to any sort of cult as well that the Elephant Graveyard goes over. And just to go over these pillars really quickly, and when I say pillars, these are the structures that make the hyperreal simulacrum stable. Because I think, as we'll get into a little bit more, any hyperreal simulacrum has a tendency to instability because it's not actually reality, right? It's very much a construction within the relationship of technology, and it's, individuals have to make some sorts of moves or commitments to be there. We're going to talk about the bigger, more interesting philosophical move. But the other component is there's a whole bunch of structures that participants need to be involved in for this hyper-reality to remain stable. So those four, just really quickly, that we went over last time, those are any members of a hyper-reality are expected to defend and uphold and promote the pillars of that higher reality. that means the veneration of a leader or the institutions or whatever within the context of that reality. It also means like guarding against and arguing against any, or ignoring, or however you're going to respond to any sort of criticism. It also involves a loyalty test. The loyalty test is effectively just believing in stuff that doesn't necessarily make sense, or you're not actually like rationally thinking through, but you're committing to because it's symbolic of your membership, right? You know, an account of this would be like if someone was living in Stalinist Russia or Maoist China or whatever, you know, even if they didn't personally necessarily, they weren't like totally gung-ho on the leader, they might start putting up pictures of the leader around their home or in their window or in their workplace or whatever. It's those sorts of actions that function as a loyalty test, and you need to prove that you're loyal both to maintain your own effectively sanity and to protect yourself against retribution within the context of other individuals within the hyper-reality. The second pillar is particularly within the context of media. This is really important, is displaying yourself as anti-mainstream, as counter culture. So we talked a little bit about how, as pointed out in the video, Joe Rogan and the Rogan Spirit and other people are some of the most famous people on the planet. They are effectively media moguls, and yet they still display themselves as being this kind of like underdog, alternative media, blah, 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 blah. You know, even though he literally has the President of the United States on his podcast, and, you know, the head of the FBI, and like, you know, big names in the military industrial complex and stuff. It's like jokes. It's like hilarious to be like, you know, we're still the underdog. We're like not like the mainstream. And then literally to have like the man on and being like, oh, we're such great friends. But again, like all of these incoherences, like any hyper-reality, I think it is trying to, on the one hand, they're trying to smooth them out, right? We don't want these distortions. But on the other hand, the coping with the distortions is part of the commitment process. Believing in the lies, believing in the BS is part of how you maintain that whole structure in and of itself. So there's that kind of weird tension going on there. The third pillar is basically just believing that individuals within this new hyper-reality are something special. Within the context of Joe Rogan, he talks a lot about how he's a real comedian and he hangs out with real comedians, and he talks about how there's only 200 comedians, real comedians in the world or whatever. Like, you know, it's just like completely made up. It's not real.
It's completely bonkers that there's only 200 comedians. It's functional, right? It sustains the whole point of these pillars. Like, what do pillars do? They uphold the stability of a building. The social reality that something like this has is not the object permanence of a chair, right? Like, chairs stay together because they're made of matter, but social relations are not like chairs, right? If you leave the social relations alone, they dissipate because they're constituted by relations. So you have to maintain the relations that constitute this reality.
Yeah, and that becomes by participating in the pillars and believing the big lies and all this kind of stuff, right? You have to do all the things that make, you can't, like, again, hyper-reality, well, I don't think there's a one-to-one relationship with hyper-reality and cults in terms of, like, what they're actually like. I think it's a good enough analogy for the purposes of our video and the context of the topic we're talking about today. Within the context of any kind of cult, you know, cult members need to be participants. There's no layabouts in a cult, right? Like, there has to be something unique, there has to be something special, and there has to be something participatory going on, right? So, in relation to that a little bit too, the fourth pillar is, you know, believing that you have the secret truth, believing that you're a truth teller, believing that you're an oppressed victim that's trying to be silenced, right? This is another classic thing, right? You know, if there's some sort of tension between your hyper-reality and what we call, like, classic reality, then there's a way that you need to, like, factor that in. And the general way that that's factored in is turning the entities and characters and actors in classic reality, as much as you recognize that, as being some sort of enemy, right? And the big example with Joe Rogan and all these sorts of people is, like, the wokeism, right? Like, you know, it's the woke left, the wokesters, you know, and it's this nebulous, you know, evil force that they're constantly at battle with and who's constantly trying to silence them, even though, you know, they're filling up stadiums and arenas for their shows and have millions of followers online and have the biggest, you know, talk show in the world and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, they're constantly under threat. And it's ostensibly just about comedy and how it's been taken over by this guy, Joe Rogan, who's like not actually funny, but people believe, like, you know, people, he's the kingmaker now. He's the power broker. He's the one that holds, you know, the philosophical, the analogous Palantir, and he seems like he's kind of the main guy. But in reality, this hyperreal simulacrum is a puppet that's functioning within a larger hyperreal simulacrum, which is this larger, you know, kind of like hyper elite tech bro, technocracy oriented, you know, class of individuals. Like, you know, he brings up the examples like Zuckerberg and Peter Thiel and Elon Musk and people like this, who have actual material, political, and economic control over present media, right? They are the real power brokers. They're the real, and they have their own hyper reality that they exist in, much more separate from our own, we could probably presume, and much more even separate than Joe's. But they also have the keys to the mechanisms of the actual present media systems, right? And have a basically anointed, operated, and encouraged Joe Rogan in this whole sphere to head in a particular direction, effectively for political and propagandistic ends, right? Like he's becoming a mouthpiece, you know, of this subsection, who have their whole own ideology and outlook and ends that aren't necessarily tied to the hyperreality that Joe and these people exist in, but are just being used for that purpose and kind of encouraging the movement that they have and their larger ideas and stuff like that. A little bit of a conspiratorial sounding system. However, I don't actually think it's like that. When you really think about it, it's not like that unrealistic as an actual description of how media and power actually function.
Any kind of like systematic account like that is going to try and have like, it's almost like a social theory of everything, is going to kind of have that character of a conspiracy. But it just is, it's like aesthetically conspiratorial. It's not actually like speculating about unseen forces or anything. Like, just like the Elephant Graveyard says, like, there's a caption in the video where it says Peter Thiel is real. Like, these are people who are real. They have addresses and stuff like that. Their motivations are not obscure, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's they have an image. There's two things we can immediately talk about before going on our main topic that come to my mind, which is, one, they have an interest in presenting themselves in a certain way, which is most obviously, you know, started by, like, say, Joe Rogan's interview of Donald Trump, or his interviews of Peter Thiel or whatever. But, like, Trump is a great example. Like, Trump is clearly, like, he was there during the election cycle. He's clearly trying to sell himself. He's not presenting himself. He's presenting his ideological movement. He's presenting, you know, his reasons for being in power. He's presenting his image as the kind of guy that he is, right? So that's very clearly, it's very clearly propagandistic, right? So there's the way that these people want to represent themselves, but then there's also the way in which these individuals can and do effectively control the algorithm and system that sort of pushes people to think and want certain things and behave certain ways. And actually, early on in the video, he actually hints at this before getting to the section at the very end. And by the way, for our listeners, the video is quite long. It's an hour and a half. It's more like watching a documentary. But he basically, you know, like, if you want to control human migrations, if you want to control the kinds of realities that people want to go to, then controlling the technological interface that sort of directs them into whatever hyperreality they're going to be in, or what that hyperreality more generally is going to look like, if you make that interface cause people to believe that things are bad, or make them anxious or angry or unhappy, well, now you've put them in a position where they want to go, I need to get the hell out of here, right? I need to migrate. And you can also be in the position to direct where those people are going to migrate to, right? where are people's consciousnesses, where are people's focuses going to end up, right? If you can both set the stage for wanting that transition and then also set the point of the transition point, then you have effectively enclosed the system and given the illusion of choice.
Joe Rogan's whole world is formed out of the impetus that gene, the I gotta get the hell out of here gene. If you can control the migration of people who want to gravitate into these, you know, hyper realities where they're coping with classical reality, you have control over people's capacities to form realities, right? You have the capacity to control social reality. And that is, I don't know, that, I mean, that sounds like something that, you know, big rich people would want to have.
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes people are like, oh, it sounds good. I like to say, we've done episodes in the past on conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorism. So it's, on the one hand, you know, you want to be cautious. But on the other hand, the other thing that would come out of those episodes that we've done in the past, and if anyone's kind of familiar with the literature on conspiracy theories, is here's the thing. Conspiracies do happen, right? Like history teaches us that. That's a real thing, right? And it happens in particular when there's vectors of power and things like new media and new systems that can direct large amounts of people and energies and material in particular kinds of ways, right? So, you know, while they may not be, spraying the, you know, disease-causing mind control bots from airplanes, you know, it's not unreasonable. It seems quite realistic to think that someone like Mark Zuckerberg would be fully aware of how something like Facebook and Instagram can have mass effects and directional abilities on the wider population. Like, that's just, like, blatantly obvious. Of course they have motives, of course they have those interests, and they live and exist in such a world in their own hyper-reality, in their own space, where, you know, like, those motives may very well not align at all. He believes in cool stuff like how freedom and democracy are not, you know, are not coherent with each other. That's my freedom. That's our democracy. But there's another sub-philosophical idea that we really wanted to get into, and it's brought up in the video. It's under Camus, and it's this idea of suicide, frankly, and the different kinds of suicides that people can commit and those relationships to making these sorts of migratory transitions.
If we're looking at what his overall framework of hyper-realities and how they form, we have this movement of people who got to get the hell out of here and they got to go to a new reality, right? Well, the reason they're moving from that new reality, or they're moving from classical reality into a formed hyper-reality, is because they can't cope with classical reality. There's something about it that activates the migration gene. I got to get the hell out of here, right? Now, Camus says that actually something kind of similar happens with, you know, the various cases of suicide. And suicide isn't just physical. We'll get into the other kind. I don't have his dates or anything, but Camus was a 20th century French Algerian, considered an existentialist, but by his own banner was an absurdist philosopher, writer, novelist, playwright. He existed within that existentialist French milieu post-World War II, being friends and interlocutors with the likes of Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, just generally existing in that and responding to and extrapolating upon existentialist French thought.
He wrote a number of novels, including, you know, The Stranger and The Plague, which are kind of, you know, widely considered works of sort of classic philosophical fiction now. But he is also someone who really introduced this idea of absurdism into philosophy, which, well, obviously, like, to simplify for our, it's actually not the most, of all the philosophical ideas, it's not like the most complicated, but basically, my own reading of it, having read Camus a couple times through it, is, you know, human beings have this desire for meaning, right? We have this, we exist, we have this desire for meaning, and we are constantly at odds with the fact that the world doesn't have anything to say back, right, to that meaning, right? We search, we scream, we look, find, and at the end of the day, you can always be left with, like, kind of a big question mark as to what this is all about, why are we here? Why are we doing this? And he kind of says within the context of this, you know, there's one philosoph, very famously, he says at the beginning of his essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, you know, there's one important philosophical question, and that is whether or not to commit suicide, right? Is life worth living, given the fact that it's, you know, that you can never really know, like, why you're here and what it's about?
The kind of existential stake on the table, right? Is your life worth, or is life in general worth living? I mean, we will answer that